I think I'll do better at home, I said. If Mom disagreed, she didn't have the energy to put up a fight. I expect you to work hard, she said. School is school, no matter where you go. I told her I knew that and went up to my room. Sometimes I feel like my room is the only safe place left. I wonder if Megan feels that way, if that's why she doesn't leave hers. Life sucks. I wish I had some fudge. September 1st. I picked up my textbooks. Either textbooks are a lot heavier than they used to be, or I don't have as much strength as I did 3 months ago. September 2nd. There didn't seem to be much point starting schoolwork on a Friday. September 5th. Labor Day. I'll look over my textbooks tomorrow. Chapter 12. September 6th. I told Mom I was doing history. She never would have believed me if I said math, and stayed in bed all morning. I finally got out around 11 and went downstairs to get something to eat. It was 23 degrees outside, but there was no heat on in the house, and the wood stove wasn't going. I heated a can of soup and ate that. Then I went back to bed. That afternoon, I heard Mom go up to her bedroom. She's been taking naps lately, which is something she never did. You think she'd be teaching Johnny or something, but I don't think she cares about his schoolwork any more than she cares about mine. Not that I blame her. So, I'm in bed, wearing my flannel pajamas and my robe and two pairs of socks, and there are three blankets and a quilt over me, and I'm trying to decide which is worse, being cold or being hungry. Part of me says the worst thing is being bored, and if I did some schoolwork, I'd be distracted. But I tell that part of me to shut up. I got out of bed, and something made me go to the pantry. I've been choosing not to see how our supplies are holding out, because I don't want to know. I want to believe everything is just going to work out and food will magically appear. In some ways it already has, and I want to think it always will. Mom's let us know she'd prefer us not to go to the pantry. Whatever food is available for us to eat, she leaves in the kitchen cabinets. I guess she doesn't want us to worry. Matt and Johnny were outside working on our wood supply. I told myself I should join them. I should go out to gather more kindling. But the truth is, even the woods scare me these days. The pantry actually kind of reassured me. It looked to me like there were lots of cans of food and boxes of pasta and rice. Horton's supplies were in one corner, and there seemed to be plenty of canned and boxed food for him and bags of kitty litter. Mom's a stockpiler under the best of circumstances, so the pantry is always pretty full. She probably had a near-full pantry back in May. Seeing all those cans and boxes and bags of food made me mad. Like, why are we starving ourselves when we still have food? When the food runs out, we'll probably die, so what difference does it make if that's November or January or March? Why not eat while we can? That's when I saw the bag of chocolate chips. I'd forgotten all about them, how I'd thrown them into my shopping cart on crazy shopping day. I went a little crazy. There was food in the pantry that Mom wasn't letting us eat, and there was chocolate, real chocolate in the house, and Mom was hoarding it because it has no nutritional value, and if we're only eating a little bit every day, we're better off with spinach. And they were my damn chocolate chips. I ripped open the bag, and I poured chocolate chips down my throat. I could hardly taste them, I was swallowing so fast. I must have devoured a third of the bag before I could calm down enough to savor the taste. Chocolate. It tasted just the way I had remembered, only better. I couldn't stop eating them. I knew I was making myself sick. My stomach was already protesting, but I kept flinging chocolate chips into my mouth. I didn't want to share the chocolate with anybody. It was mine. Miranda! It's funny. Somehow, I knew I'd get caught. Maybe because I was prepared, I made the moment as dramatic as possible. I swallowed another mouthful of chips and wiped my mouth with the back of my hand. I must have seen that in a movie somewhere. It worked. Mom started screaming. I'm not even sure she was coherent. I was, though. I screamed right back at her. She was hoarding food. We didn't have to starve. Why wasn't she letting us eat three meals a day? What difference did any of it make? I still had the bag of chocolate chips in my hand, and I made some kind of wild gesture because the chips went flying all over the pantry floor. Mom froze. That was a lot scarier than her hysterics. I froze too for a moment. Then I started picking the chocolate chips off the floor. I got a handful of them and didn't know whether I should put them back in the bag. I stood there like an idiot waiting for Mom to become human again. "Eat them," she said. "What? Eat them. You wanted them. Eat them. Pick them up and eat them. They're yours. Eat them all. I don't want to see a single chocolate chip on the floor." I bent down and started picking up all the chocolate chips from the floor. As I gathered them, I put them in my mouth. Whenever I missed one, Mom pointed it out to me. She actually kicked a couple of them toward me and told me to eat them. I really felt sick by then. Finally, I got all the chocolate chips off the floor. There was still about a quarter of a bag left. "Eat them," Mom said. "Mom, I don't think I can," I said. "Eat them," she said. I thought I'd throw up, but Mom terrified me. I don't know why, she wasn't even yelling at that point. It was like talking to an icicle. She stood there, absolutely still, and watched me eat each and every last chocolate chip. I thought, this isn't my mom. This is some strange creature that's taken over her body. Then I thought it would serve her right if I threw up all over her, but I managed not to. "Give me the bag," she said, when I'd finally gotten the last chocolate chip down. I did as she told me. "Fine," she said. "That was your food for today and tomorrow. You can join us for supper on Thursday." "Mom!" I yelled. "It was just some chocolate chips!" "I was saving them for Matt's birthday," she said. "I'm not going to tell him why he isn't getting any dessert on his birthday. I don't expect you to tell him either. But you've eaten enough for four people, so you're going to skip your next four meals. Maybe then you'll understand how important food really is." "I'm sorry," I said. I hadn't been thinking about Matt. His birthday is in a couple of weeks, but what are birthdays nowadays? Can't you make him something else for his birthday? "What you did was wrong," Mom said. She sounded more mom-like by then, or at least the mom I've gotten to know over the past few months. "I can't have you or your brothers walking in here and eating whatever you feel like. This food has to last all of us for as long a time as possible. Why can't you understand that? What if you stroll in here and help yourself to a can of peaches or string beans? I know you're hungry. I'm hungry too. But the only chance we have is if we are very, very careful. Maybe things will get better in a couple of months. Maybe it'll take longer. If we don't look toward the future, we have nothing to live for, and I won't have that." "I'm sorry," I said. "I'll never do it again. I promise." Mom nodded. "I know you're not a bad girl, Miranda," she said. "I know it was just thoughtlessness on your part, and punishing you doesn't make me feel any better. But I meant it about the meals. You can eat again Thursday night. It won't kill you to go without food that long. You have enough calories in you right now to last for a week. Now, just go to your room. I really don't want to deal with you anymore." My stomach aches like it used to when I'd pig out on Halloween candy. Only worse, because then I'd have a full stomach, and I wouldn't hate myself so much. I hurt Mom. Without even knowing it, I hurt Matt. Johnny, too, since he would have loved a dessert. Mrs. Nesbit. Maybe even Peter. I'm a selfish, selfish pig. I don't deserve to live. September 7th. Johnny came into my room this morning. "Mom said you ate something from the pantry yesterday," he told me, "and you're not allowed to eat again until tomorrow night. And if she ever finds out that Matt or I did that, we'll get the exact same punishment." For some reason, that made me feel better. I get it into my head sometimes that Mom loves me less than Matt or Johnny. "That's pretty much what happened," I said. Johnny looked kind of excited. "What did you eat?" he asked. "A can of string beans," I said. "Is that all?" he asked. "You can't eat today because of a can of string beans?" I told him to get the hell out of my room and stay out. And that was the only conversation I had all day. September 8th. Mom fried two potatoes from the garden. She also heated up a can of string beans. For dessert, we had a can of fruit salad. The prodigal son would have been jealous. September 12th. Monday. I should be doing schoolwork. September 14th. Matt's birthday. He's 19. For supper, we had artichoke hearts, almost like a salad, and then linguine with white clam sauce. Mrs. Nesbitt brought her home-baked oatmeal raisin cookies, which Matt likes, but not nearly as much as he likes chocolate. Thinking about that made me feel sick all over again. I ate one cookie. I knew Mom would be furious if I didn't, but it tasted like dust. Megan's right about my being a sinner, but she's wrong about hell. You don't have to wait until you're dead to get there. September 16th. Matt went to the post office today and brought home two letters from Dad. The first was from a day or two after he left. It said how wonderful it was to see all of us and how he was so proud of us and he knew we'd be okay and we'd see each other again soon. The second letter was dated August 16th. He and Lisa had made it to the Kansas border, but Kansas wasn't letting anyone in unless they could prove they had parents or children who owned property there, which, of course, he and Lisa don't. The border guards didn't care that all they wanted to do was drive through Kansas to get to Colorado. He said that they had some options. There were rumors of officials who could be persuaded to look the other way. "What does that mean?" Johnny asked. "Bribed," Matt explained. "Give them what they want, and they let you in." The problem with that was first you had to find the official, Dad went on, and then you had to have something he wanted. In addition, there were restrictions against letting pregnant women in, and Lisa's pregnancy was showing. They could try to get in by a back road, but there were reports of vigilantes keeping strangers out. They could drive down to Oklahoma and get to Colorado that way. They didn't have enough gas, and rumors were things were as bad or worse in Oklahoma, but they were still thinking about it. Lisa was determined to get to her parents. The temperature was about 40, and he and Lisa were staying at a refugee camp. No heat, no food, limited plumbing. They were only allowed one more day there, and then they had to get back on the road. If they had to, they could go back to Missouri. Because of the earthquakes there, the state was pretty much unpoliced. That was pretty much how the letter ended, and it scared all of us. Dad never wants us to worry. 3 years ago, when he lost his job, he made it sound like it was his life's dream to be out of work. Life is full of unexpected opportunities. When a window closes, a door opens. And of course, for him, the door did open. He got the job in Springfield, met Lisa, and the next thing we all knew, he was married with a baby on the way. Only now Dad wasn't talking about windows and doors and unexpected opportunities. It was the first report we've had in a long time about what's going on outside of Pennsylvania. Travel restrictions, vigilantes, refugee camps. And that's in the part of the country where things are supposed to be better. "I'm sure we'll get another letter from him soon," Mom said, saying he and Lisa have made it to her parents and that everything is all right. We all knew she was saying that because she had to. If we never hear from Dad again, we'll never know what became of him. It's possible he and Lisa will make it to Colorado, and things there aren't horrible, and they'll be okay and the baby will be okay, and we'll never know. At least that's what I'm telling myself, because I don't want to tell myself anything else. September 17th. I went out to get kindling. I've been such a baby afraid of the big bad forest. And when I came back, I found Mom sobbing at the kitchen table. I dropped the bags of kindling and went over and hugged her. Then I asked what had happened. "Nothing," she said. "I was thinking about that man. The one the day we bought the groceries, with the baby on the way. The baby should be born by now. And I started thinking about if it is okay. If he and his wife and their other child are okay and... I don't know. It just got to me." "I know," I said, because I did know. Sometimes it's safer to cry about people you don't know than to think about people you really love. Chapter 13. September 18th. Matt and Johnny were at Mrs. Nesbitt's this morning getting her house ready for winter. She refuses to move in with us. When I came in for brunch, I'd just taken out the can of peas and carrots when I heard a thud and Mom cry out. I ran to the living room, and there was Mom sprawled out on the floor. "I tripped," she said. "I am such an idiot. I tripped." "Are you okay?" I asked. She shook her head. "My ankle," she said. "I don't think I can stand on it." "Stay where you are," I said, like she had a choice. "I'll get Peter." I ran to the garage and got my bike. I've never biked as fast as I did to the hospital. But when I got there, they wouldn't let me in, even when I explained there had been an accident and we were friends with Peter. All the guard would do was take my message. I stood outside waiting. The house is so cold we all wear extra layers and jackets, but I'd been in such a hurry I hadn't thought to put on my winter coat or gloves or a scarf. I'd worked up a sweat biking so fast, and that didn't help any. The guard didn't seem to be in any hurry to take my message to Peter. First he made me write it out, and then he read it, and then he demanded I show him some ID, which, of course, I didn't have on me. I begged him to take the message to Peter. He grinned. I could tell he was used to people begging him for things, and he liked it. I felt the same kind of nauseous sick I'd felt from the chocolate chips. I stood there begging and crying and wanting to kill him. So help me, if I could have gotten my hands on his gun, I would have shot him and anybody else who tried to keep me from getting help from Mom. The guard stood there and laughed. Then a second guard came by and asked what was going on. I told him. He didn't laugh, but he did say there was nothing they could do to help. "This is a hospital," he said. "The doctors don't make house calls." The first guard thought that was a riot. "Just let me get the message to Dr. Elliot," I said. "That's all I'm asking." "We can't leave our post to bring someone a message," the second guard said. "Your best bet is to wait here, and if someone you know comes out, maybe you can get him to take the message in." "Please," I begged. "Please. My mother is lying, alone, hurt. Please don't make me wait here any longer." "Sorry, miss," the second guard said. "We have our rules, too." The first guard just kept grinning. So I stood there. People left the hospital, but none of them was willing to go back and bring Peter my note. They all pretended not to see me, like I was a beggar on the street and they didn't want to have to give me money or feel guilty because they hadn't. I stood for as long as I could, and then I sat down on the frozen ground. The first guard walked over to me and gave me a little nudge with his shoe. "No loitering," he said. "Stand or go." "Sorry, miss," the second guard said. "Rules." I kept thinking of Mom, wondering if I should go back home. It was so hard to tell how much time had elapsed. It felt like hours, but I had no way of knowing. Johnny had probably gone back to the house. Mom had given him orders not to eat any of Mrs. Nesbitt's food, so he probably came home for lunch. At least that's what I told myself. I couldn't bear the thought of going home without Peter, and I couldn't bear the thought of Mom all alone on the living room floor. I told myself Johnny had gone home and brought Mom some blankets and helped her off the floor and everything was okay. I hadn't eaten since supper the night before, and I started feeling woozy. I felt myself kind of floating onto the ground. I don't think I really lost consciousness, because I remember the second guard coming over and lifting me up.
"Don't do that, miss," he said. "It won't do you any good."
I think I thanked him. I went back to standing and willed myself not to faint, not to cry. I asked more people who came out to help me. No one paid any attention. The first guard said something about getting something to eat. He sauntered off like going for a meal was the most normal thing in the world to do. I thought maybe the second guard would take pity on me then and let me in, but he just stood there and refused to look at me. Then, Matt showed up. "Mom's worried sick," he said. "What's going on here?" "Matt?" the second guard said. "Mr. James?" Matt said. "I didn't realize this was your sister," the guard said. "Go in. Hurry. I could get in a lot of trouble if Dwayne finds out what I did." Matt raced into the hospital. Dwayne came back while Matt was still in the hospital.
"Are you still here?" he said,
but I ignored him. After a few minutes, Matt and Peter came outside. "We'll take my car," Peter said. "I have a bike rack." It was all I could do not to burst into tears. At that moment, I realized I no longer had the strength to bike home. The drive took maybe 10 minutes. I was too exhausted and sick and worried to enjoy the sensation of being in a car. Matt explained that Johnny had gone home around 1, and when he found Mom on the floor, she was more worried about me than about herself. She was pretty sure nothing was broken, but she couldn't stand, and Johnny wasn't strong enough to help her get up. She sent Johnny to Mrs. Nesbitt's to get Matt, and he came home and carried Mom to the sunroom and started a fire. Then he biked over to the hospital to find me. I'd been standing outside for about 3 hours. Peter didn't even try to apologize for the guards. He said there had been incidents, and conditions at the hospital were bad enough without people breaking in. I know he might be right, but I didn't want to hear it. And even though it was crazy of me, it made me mad that Matt could get in because the guard knew him, and I couldn't because the guard didn't know me. I told myself to be grateful the guard knew Matt, but the last thing I was feeling was gratitude. Peter pulled into the driveway and went right into the sunroom. Matt and I unloaded our bikes from the rack. "You okay?" Matt asked me. "Did the guards give you a hard time?" "I'm fine," I said. But the truth was, I longed to take a hot shower and wash the whole experience away. All I could think of was how much pleasure Dwayne had gotten out of my misery. I still would have killed him if I had the chance. But I didn't tell Matt any of that. He didn't need to hear it. We went inside and found Peter examining Mom's ankle. "A bad sprain," he said. "But nothing's broken. She won't need a cast." He pulled an ace bandage out of his doctor's bag and wrapped up her ankle tightly. "Don't even think about stairs for a week," he said. "Stay in here. Matt, you and I will bring your mother's mattress down here. Laura, you can get up to eat and go to the bathroom, but nothing more. Keep your foot propped up when you're sitting. Put as little weight on it as possible. I don't suppose you have a cane." "There's one in the attic," Mom said. "I'll get it," Johnny said. He grabbed a flashlight and flew up the stairs. While he was gone, Peter pulled out some surgical masks and handed them to us. "Air quality," he said, almost apologetically. "We're seeing a lot of asthma cases these days. You might want to wear one of these whenever you do anything outside." "Thank you," Mom said. "Matt, wear one when you chop wood. Do you understand?" "Yes, Mom," Matt said. He quickly put one on. "Mom always wanted me to be a doctor," he said, and we all pretended to laugh. Johnny came down with the cane. Peter inspected it and declared it acceptable. Mom wasn't to walk anywhere without it for the next 10 days. She wasn't even to think about leaving the house for 2 weeks. He'd try to get over once or twice to check on her in the meantime. Then he and Matt went upstairs and lugged Mom's mattress down. I brought her sheets and blankets and pillows. Johnny shoved the furniture around so there'd be room for the mattress. With the wood stove giving off heat and light, the sunroom looked almost cheerful. "I feel like such a fool," Mom said. "I'm putting everyone to so much bother. And Peter, I know how busy you are. I can't thank you enough for coming over." "Oh, Laura," Peter said, and he took her hand. I realized if things had been normal, if none of this insanity had happened, he and Mom would have been going out for the past 4 months, regular, normal going out, and Mom would have been happy. Mom asked Peter if he could stay for supper, but Peter said he had to go back to the hospital. They were all on crazy schedules, 16 hours on, 8 hours off, because the staff was no longer at full strength. He really couldn't take any more time off. "But I'll be back," he said. "I promise. And I want you to promise you'll stay off that foot and let the ankle heal on its own. There's no reason for you to limp any longer than necessary." "I promise," Mom said. Peter bent down and kissed her. Then he left, and we could hear the sound of his car. Such a funny sound. "I'm so sorry," Mom said to us. "I know this is going to be a terrible bother for all of you." "Don't worry about it," Matt said. "We just want you to follow Peter's instructions and get better." "I'll take care of suppers," I said. "Don't worry about that, Mom." "I'm not worrying about anything," Mom said. "I know you'll all do whatever has to be done. I just wish I could help you. I know I'm going to have to be strong for the next couple of weeks. No more whining, no more picking fights. I'll have to do whatever Mom asks me and not protest and not complain. I know I can do it." But for that one moment, I felt so weak, so helpless. I felt nothing but fear and despair and the most awful need to be any place else. I told myself it was hunger, but I knew that was a lie. As long as Mom was all right, I could fool myself into thinking we'd all be all right. But even though I knew Mom could have fallen any time and sprained her ankle any time, this felt as though it was the beginning of the end. So while Matt and Johnny were busying themselves getting Mom set up, I slipped upstairs to my bedroom and wrote all this down. All the things I could never tell any of them. I thought of Dad and how I may never see him again. I thought of Lisa and wondered if she and the baby would be all right. If I'd ever get to know if I had a new sister or brother. I thought of Grandma and wondered if she was still alive. I cried and I pounded my pillow, pretending it was Dwayne. And when I calmed down, I wrote, "And now I'll go downstairs and make supper and pretend everything is just fine." September 19th. Mom was looking lonely in the sunroom this afternoon, so I decided to keep her company. She was sitting on the couch with her foot propped up, and I sat down next to her. "I want to thank you," she said, "and tell you how proud I am of you." "Of me?" I said. "The way you raced out of here when I fell," she said. "I know you've been reluctant to go any place on your own, but you didn't hesitate for a moment. And standing there all that time, I'm very grateful, and I'm very proud." "I wish I could have done more," I said. "I felt awful leaving you that way. It never occurred to me they wouldn't let me in." Mom reached over and began stroking my hair. "You are so beautiful," she said. "The past few months have been so awful, and you've been very brave. I've been at fault not telling you that. I'm so proud to be your mother." I didn't know what to say. I thought about all the fights I'd provoked over the past few months. "We'll get through," Mom said. "We have each other, and we'll survive." "I know we will," I said. Mom sighed. "You know what I miss most?" she asked. And then she laughed. "At least today. It changes every day." "No, what?" I asked. "Clean hair," she said. "Daily showers and clean hair. My hair is such a mess. I really hate it." "It's okay," I said. "It's no worse than mine." "Let's cut it," she said. "Miranda, get a pair of scissors and cut my hair. Come on, do it right now." "You sure?" I asked. "Positive," she said. "Hurry." I found a pair of scissors and brought it back to her. "I've never cut hair before," I said. "What do I have to lose?" she asked. "It's not like I'm going to any fancy parties." "Cut it real short. It'll be easier to keep clean that way." I didn't have the slightest idea what I was doing, but Mom cheered me on and reminded me to cut from the top as well as the sides and back. When I finished, Mom looked like a plucked chicken. No, worse. She looked like a plucked chicken that hadn't eaten in months. The cut emphasized her cheekbones, and you could see how much weight she'd lost. "Do me a favor," I said. "Don't look in a mirror." "That bad?" she asked. "Oh, well, it'll grow out. That's the great thing about hair. Do you want me to cut yours?" "No," I said. "I've been thinking of letting my hair grow real long." "Cornrows," she said. "Those little braids, they don't need shampooing too often. Do you want me to braid your hair like that?" "I don't think so," I said, picturing me with cornrows and Mom with her new punk hairstyle. Mom stared at me, and then she burst out laughing. It was real laughter, too, and before I knew it, I was laughing as hard as I had in months. I think I'd forgotten how much I love Mom. It was good to be reminded. September 20th. I went to visit Mrs. Nesbitt this afternoon. Mom used to go almost every day, but she can't now, so I volunteered. She had her furnace going, and her house was actually warm. "I don't know how long the oil is going to last," she said. "But then again, I don't know how long I'm going to last. I figure as long as I don't know which of us is going to go first, I might as well stay warm." "You can move in with us," I said. "Mom really wants you to." "I know she does," Mrs. Nesbitt said, "and it's selfish of me to stay here. But I was born in this house, and I would prefer to die in it." "Maybe you won't die," I said. "Mom says we'll make it through." "I believe you will," Mrs. Nesbitt said. "You're young and strong and healthy, but I'm an old woman. I've lived a lot longer than I ever thought, and now it's my time for dying." Mrs. Nesbitt hasn't heard from her son and his family since the first tsunamis.
There's no way of knowing if any of them are still alive. I guess Mrs. Nesbit feels she would have heard from one of them by now if they still were. We talked about all kinds of stuff. Mrs. Nesbit always has stories about Mom when she was growing up. She used to babysit Mom's mother, and I think I like those stories the best. I know Mom loves to hear them, since she was so young when her parents died. I'll go back tomorrow. There's so little I can do. But visiting with her and making sure she's okay and then reassuring Mom about it is something. One good thing about Mom's sprained ankle. She's forgotten that I should be doing schoolwork. I don't think she's been pestering Johnny either. What a strange, strange life this is. I wonder what it'll be like when things get back to normal. If they ever do. Food and showers and sunlight and school. Dates. Okay, I never had dates. But if I'm going to dream, I might as well dream big. September 23rd. Peter managed to drop by. He checked Mom's ankle and agreed it was definitely getting better, but she still shouldn't put any weight on it. We left Mom and Peter alone for a while. He probably told her about diseases and accidents and plagues. He's entitled. I noticed how much older he's looking. I should have noticed it last week, but I was so crazed by the time I saw him, I didn't really see anything. It's not just that he's thinner. There's a sadness in his eyes. He seems weary. I mentioned that to Matt when we had a chance to be by ourselves. Well, he's dealing with illness all the time, Matt pointed out. Most of his patients are probably dying. And he's alone. He's divorced and he had two daughters, but they both died. I didn't know that, I said. Mom told me, he said. I guess all the worrying Peter would do for his own family, he's doing for us. How am I going to feel when people I love start dying? September 26th. Matt and I went to the library today. It's only open on Mondays now. They don't know how much longer they'll stay open. As we were leaving, I saw Michelle Schmidt. I guess she hasn't vanished after all. I wonder how much I hear is true and how much is just made up. Maybe everything is fine with the world and we just don't know it. The joke would sure be on us if that's the case. September 29th. It's funny how much I'm enjoying things these days. I think we all are. We're so used to worrying, we hardly even notice it. Actually, life is pretty cozy. We have the wood stove going full-time because of Mom, so there's always a warm spot in the house. We spend our daytimes doing whatever needs to be done. Matt and Johnny are still bringing in firewood. Better too much than too little is Matt's mantra, and I can't argue with him. I'm doing whatever housework there is to be done. The worst is the clothes washing, which has to be done with as little water as possible, all by hand, and very yucky. And visiting Mrs. Nesbit every afternoon. I go after lunchtime so she won't try to feed me. Although she does, but I always say no thanks. And I stay for an hour or so. A lot of times we hardly even talk. We just sit at the table and stare out the kitchen window together. Mom says she and Mrs. Nesbit do the same thing, so I shouldn't worry. Mom now trusts me to go to the pantry, and I get to select our suppers. A can of this and a can of that. There's less food there than there was when I had my great chocolate chip feast, but as long as we don't eat too much, we'll be okay for a while. Ever since I saw Michelle Schmidt and realized she had never disappeared the way kids at school thought she had, I feel like things really are better than we've been letting ourselves believe. So what if I'm deluding myself? Better to delude myself that things are okay than to delude myself that things are doomed. At least this way I smile. After supper, when we're all feeling good because we're not too hungry, we've taken to playing poker. I like 7-card stud the best. Johnny and Matt like Texas Hold'em, and Mom prefers 5-card draw. So dealer decides. Matt went into the attic and dug out a box of poker chips. Johnny is the best player, and as of tonight, I owe him $328,000 and a utility infielder. We're high-stakes gamblers. I think even Peter is feeling better about things. He came over this evening, proclaimed Mom able to walk around again as long as she's careful and avoids stairs, and he didn't mention a single new way people are dying. We convinced him to stay for supper, and I put out an extra can of tuna. This is the first time I can remember when Peter came over and didn't bring us anything. So either he's run out of supplies, or he's now officially family. I hope it's family, because I owe him $33,000 from a single hand of Omaha High. Horton is on a diet, not of his choosing. Maybe it's the warmth of the wood stove, or maybe he just hopes we'll feed him, but he's very affectionate lately. He keeps Mom company all day, and in the evenings he sits on the most available lap or else by the wood stove. Matt brought down an old portable typewriter because Mom is thinking about writing down some of the stories she knows about her great-grandmother and her family. What life was like in this house before there was electricity and indoor plumbing. I like thinking about that. It makes me feel connected, like I'm a part of some bigger thing, like family is more important than electricity. The sunroom was just a porch back then, but I can imagine my great-great-grandmother's family sitting around in the parlor with the oil lamps glowing, and the men tired out from chopping wood, and the women tired out from doing the laundry. Actually, Mom says the family had two servants, and one of them did all the laundry, but the women were probably tired out anyway. I wonder if they imagined the future. I bet they never could have guessed what things would be like today. Chapter 14. October 2nd. I turned on the stove to boil water, and no flame came out. I ran the hot water in the kitchen, and the water stayed cold. I guess Aaron's father knew what he was talking about when he said the natural gas would be turned off by October. Mom says it's okay. We can heat our food and boil our water on the wood stove. She's refusing to let us use up the last of our oil for the furnace, but at least we're not dependent on gas for our heat. A lot of families are worse off than we are. We've all been taking just one shower a week for a while now, but with no hot water, I guess no more showers at all. And no hot water is going to make washing clothes that much harder. I know it shouldn't bother me, but it does. I can see Mom's upset too, even though she's acting like she isn't. I guess it's because things have been kind of level for a while, and now they're worse again. Not big bad worse, at least not for us or Mrs. Nesbitt, who also has a wood stove and oil heat. But worse anyway. We played poker tonight, but none of us were really into it. Which is probably why, for the first time, I was the big winner. October 3rd. Matt, Johnny, and I all went to the library. Mom's ankle still isn't strong enough for her to bike. The library was open, but Mrs. Hotchkiss was the only person working there. She said that this was the last day the library would be open. They just couldn't keep it open with no heat. There was no limit on how many books we could take. Mrs. Hotchkiss told us to take as many as we possibly could. If the library reopens in the spring, we can always bring them back. So we loaded up. We had our backpacks, and the bikes all have baskets, so we managed a dozen or more books each. We looked for ourselves and for Mom, too. Since we've been playing poker, we've been reading less, and of course there are plenty of books in the house, including lots of old ones in the attic. But it's still upsetting to think the library won't be there. Mrs. Hotchkiss said she and her husband were going to Georgia. Her husband has a sister there. Johnny asked her how they were going to get there, and she said walk if they had to. The temperature's been below freezing for the past 2 weeks, she said. If it's this bad in October, none of us will make it through the winter. I think we should go too, Johnny said as we were getting on our bikes to go home. We should go to Kansas and see if we can find Dad. We don't know where Dad is, Matt said. He could be in Colorado. He could be back in Springfield. No, I said. He would have stopped off here if they came back east. We still don't know where he is, Matt said. John, Mom and I have talked about it a lot, about what we should do. There's no point in going. We have shelter. We have firewood so we won't freeze. It's not like we're going to be able to find food anyplace else. We don't know that, Johnny said. Maybe there's food in Kansas. Dad couldn't even get into Kansas, I said. Missouri, then, Johnny said. Or Oklahoma. I don't see why we're staying here just to die. We're not going to die, Matt said. You don't know that, Johnny said. What if the moon crashes in? Then it won't matter where we are. We'll die anyway, Matt said. Our chances of survival are best here. This isn't just happening to Pennsylvania, John. It's all over the world. We have a roof over our heads. We have heat. We have water. We have food. How long do you think we'd survive biking our way across country? Dad got gas, Johnny said. We could get gas. Dad bought black market gas, Matt said. He had connections. And at that, his gas ran out. Black market? I said. Matt looked at me like I was an infant. How do you think he got all that food? He said. You didn't really think it was just waiting to be taken, did you? Does Mom know? I asked. Matt shrugged. Dad and I talked about it while we were cutting down trees, he said. I don't know what he talked to Mom about. He probably didn't tell her. Mom's happier not knowing things. You know that. I do, but I didn't realize Matt knew it also. So we're stuck here? Johnny asked. I'm afraid so, Matt said. But things will get better. Maybe not right away, but we'll make it. That's Mom's answer for everything. Hold on and wait until things get better. It didn't sound any more believable coming from Matt. But I know he's right about our not going. It's like the world before Columbus. People leave and you never hear from them again. They might as well have fallen off the face of the earth. We have each other. As long as we have each other, we'll be all right. October 6th. Mom's writing again. Or, at least she's typing. I'd forgotten how hard it is, she said. The letter A in particular. My left pinky isn't really up to it on a manual typewriter. It's been so long since it rained, I don't remember what it sounds like. It's getting harder to remember sunlight also. The days are getting shorter, but it doesn't matter. The air's getting worse, too. The longer you stay out, the dirtier you are when you come in. Mom's worried about what all the ash is doing to Matt and Johnny's lungs, even with the face masks, but they still keep chopping firewood for as long as they can every day. Mom and I scrub the clothes as hard as we can, but even though we're hanging them indoors, they're still gray. We wash ourselves every night, and the washcloths are filthy, and we can never get them really clean. The towels aren't much better. Matt says if the air is getting dirtier, it probably means more volcanoes are erupting, but we have no way of knowing. The post office is still open, but less and less mail is coming, and it's all weeks or months old when it finally arrives. Anything could have happened in September, and we'd have no way of knowing. One good thing about the extra ash, it's completely blocked out the moon. Before, especially on windy nights, you could make it out, but now it's totally gone. I'm glad I don't have to see it anymore. I can pretend it's not there, and if it isn't, maybe things will get back to normal. Okay, I know that's crazy, but I'm still glad I don't have to see the moon anymore. October 10th. Columbus Day. In honor of the holiday, I asked Mom to cut my hair really short, the way I'd cut hers. Her hair hasn't grown out yet, but I've gotten used to it, and I hate washing my hair now. It never gets clean, and it's so lank and disgusting. I figured short would be better. So, Mom chopped my hair off. When she finished, I looked at myself in the mirror. It was all I could do to keep from crying. But I didn't. And Mom kissed me and hugged me and told me I was beautiful with short hair. It's a good thing the bars are closed, she said. You could pass for 21. I really do love her. At least we're not fighting anymore. Matt and Johnny came in, and I could see how shocked they were. But Matt said I looked great and asked Mom to cut his hair as well. Mom ended up cutting all our hair. We threw the hair in the wood stove and watched it sizzle. October 13th. It was 2 degrees below zero this morning. Mom and Matt had a big fight. Matt said we had to start using whatever oil we had. Mom said we should wait until November at least. Matt won the argument. He said our pipes were going to freeze and we might as well use up the well water while we still could. He and Johnny moved Mom's mattress out of the sunroom and into the kitchen. Then they went upstairs and got all the mattresses, and one by one carried them downstairs. I went upstairs, closed off the heat registers, and closed the doors. We can go back to using our bedrooms in the spring, Mom said. This isn't forever. For the time being, Mom and I are sleeping in the kitchen, and Matt and Johnny are in the living room. Mom and I are actually better off, since the kitchen gets a little bit of warmth from the wood stove in the sunroom. We also have more space. Matt, Johnny, and I piled the dining room furniture and living room furniture together, so there's room for the two mattresses in there. But they barely have space to move around. When the fuel oil runs out, we'll all move into the sunroom. I keep telling myself it isn't like I've been comfortable in my bedroom. It's freezing in there. So cold sometimes I lie in bed shivering, unable to fall asleep. But it's been the only space I could call my own. I have my candles, my flashlight, and no one tells me not to use them. I can write or read, or just pretend I'm someplace else. I guess it's better to be warm. I want to weep, and I feel like I have no place left where I can. October 14th. Matt still goes to the post office every Friday to find out if there's any news. He came in while Mom and I were washing clothes at the kitchen sink. He gestured to me, and I followed him into the pantry. I have bad news, he said. Megan's on the dead list. That's what they have now, the dead list. If you find out someone is dead, you write their name on the list. Just the local people, of course, since there's no way of knowing if anybody in the rest of the world has died. I guess I didn't say anything because Matt kept talking. Her mother is on the list, too. What? I said. Why? I'm just telling you what I know, he said. They were both on the list. I didn't see their names last week, but that doesn't mean anything. You know how the list is. Megan's dead, I said. It's funny how weird that sounded. Megan's dead. The world is dying. Megan is dead. I asked at the post office, but there were only a couple of guys there, and neither one knew anything, Matt said. Lots of people are dying. It's getting harder to keep track. Megan wanted to die, I said, but I don't think her mother did. People aren't necessarily choosing anymore, Matt said. Anyway, I thought you should know. I wonder if I cry, whether my tears would be gray. October 15th. I got up this morning and realized Reverend Marshall would know what happened to Megan and her mother. I told Mom where I was going, and she asked if I wanted Matt to come along. I said no, I'd be fine. Actually, I didn't care if I was going to be fine or not. What difference does it make? It took me a half hour to get to Reverend Marshall's church, and by the time I got there, I was wheezing. I don't know how Matt and John are managing outdoors. I felt like ice, and I was glad to find the church had heat. There were a few people praying in the church. I haven't seen anyone other than family since the library closed. It felt strange seeing people, hardly more than skeletons, really. I had to remind myself how to speak, how to ask questions, how to say thank you. But I managed, and someone told me Reverend Marshall was in his office. I knocked on his office door and went in. I'm here about Megan Wayne, I said. I was her best friend. Her best friend on Earth, Reverend Marshall said. I didn't have the energy to argue theology with him, so I just nodded. She's dead, I said, like he wouldn't know it. And her mother, too. I thought maybe you could tell me what happened. God took them, he said. I pray for their souls. Megan's soul is just fine, I said. Her mother's, too. How exactly did God take them? Reverend Marshall looked at me like I was a mosquito he wanted to swat. It's not our place to question God's decisions, he said. I'm not questioning anyone except you, I said. What happened? God chose the moment of Megan's death, he said. What the earthly cause was, we'll never know. Her mother summoned me one morning, and we prayed over Megan's remains. She asked me to bury Megan in their backyard, but the ground was frozen, and I knew I couldn't do it alone. I went back to the church to ask for help. And when we returned to the house, we found Mrs. Wayne had hung herself. Oh, God, I said. I suppose she felt we'd bury the two of them together that way, Reverend Marshall said. But, of course, we couldn't touch her impure remains. We took Megan to the churchyard and buried her here, if you want to say goodbye to her. I'd said goodbye to Megan a long time ago, and I couldn't bear to be in that man's company a moment longer. I said no and turned around to leave. But as soon as I did, I realized there was something that was bothering me. I turned back and stared at him. Reverend Marshall had never been overweight, and he wasn't now. But he hadn't lost any weight. You're eating, I said. Your congregation is starving, and you're eating. Do you make them give you their food? My congregation chooses to bring me food, he said. I merely accept what they offer. You're despicable, I said, and I don't know which one of us was more surprised that I even knew the word. I don't believe in hell, so I'm not going to say I hope you end up there. I hope you're the last person living on Earth. I hope the whole world dies before you, and you're left here healthy and well-fed and alone. Then you'll know what Mrs. Wayne felt. Then you'll know what impure really is. I'll pray for you, he said, as Megan would have wished me to. Don't bother, I said. I don't want any favors from your God. I guess people heard me, because a couple of men came in and escorted me out. I didn't put up any resistance. Frankly, I couldn't get out of there fast enough. I biked over to Megan's house. The front door was wide open. The house was so cold I could see my breath. I was scared I'd find Megan's mom, but her body was gone. The house had been ransacked, but that's to be expected. Whenever a house is deserted, people come in and take everything that can possibly be used. I went up to Megan's bedroom. Her bed was still there, so I sat down and thought about what she'd been like when we first became friends. I remembered fights with her, and going to the movies, and that stupid science project we worked on together in seventh grade. I thought about Becky, how Megan, Sammy, and I would visit her, and how we'd laugh. Even though Becky was so ill, and we were so frightened, I sat on Megan's bed until I couldn't bear it anymore. When I got home, I went straight to the pantry and closed the door. I guess Mom wasn't worried I'd eat anything because she left me alone in there until she needed to get food out for supper. It made me sick to eat, but I ate anyway. Starvation was Megan's way out, not mine. I'll live. We'll live. I will never make Mom face what Mrs. Wayne faced. My existence is the only gift I have left to give her, but it will have to do. October 18th. I dreamed about Megan last night. I was walking into homeroom, and I realized it was my seventh grade homeroom. And there was Megan, and she was talking with Becky. I got very confused. Is this heaven? I asked. I hated seventh grade, and the very idea that it was heaven was upsetting. Megan laughed. This is hell, she said. Can't you tell them apart yet? I woke up then. It's funny sharing the kitchen with Mom. I feel like she knows what I'm dreaming, like even my thoughts aren't private anymore. But she slept through my dream. I guess she has dreams of her own. October 21st. Matt came home from the post office today and said unless they had volunteers they were going to have to close. So he's volunteered to work there on Fridays. Why bother? John asked. We're not going to hear from Dad. We don't know that, Mom said. I think working at the post office is a good idea. We all should be doing more than we are. It isn't good for us to sit around and do nothing. We need to be out, doing things for other people. We need to have a reason to be alive. I rolled my eyes. I bring in kindling and visit Mrs. Nesbit and wash our clothes and clean Horton's litter. I mean, that's my life. Sitting in the kitchen with Mrs. Nesbit, with neither of us saying a word, is the high point of my day. All right, Mom said. You don't have to say anything. Who, me? John and I said simultaneously, which really was pretty funny. This isn't fun for any of us, Mom said. Matt, I'm glad you'll be working at the post office. Johnny, Miranda, do whatever you want. I'm past caring. There's a part of me that almost wishes she meant it. But most of me is scared that maybe she really did mean it. October 24th. The temperature was 17 this morning, which practically constitutes a heat wave nowadays. If you looked up at the sky hard enough, you could almost make out the sun. Indian summer, Mom said when the thermometer reached 29. No, I mean it. I bet if the ash weren't so thick, this would be Indian summer. We keep the thermostat at 50 degrees, so it's always cold. I figured I might never see 29 degrees again. I'm going skating, I said. The pond's been frozen for a month by now. Mom, are your skates still in your closet? I suppose so, she said. Be careful, Miranda. Don't take any chances with the ice breaking. I won't, I said, but I was so excited I hardly cared what she said. Mom's shoe size and mine are close enough that I knew her skates would fit me fairly well. I went upstairs and found her skates in no time. I'd forgotten how beautiful ice skates are. I haven't been to Miller's Pond since I stopped swimming. I spent a lot of time in the woods around our house, but this was the longest I'd walked in them in months. The path was covered with dead leaves, but I didn't have any trouble following it. The strangest thing about the walk was how quiet things were. I'm really used to quiet by now. No TV, no computer, no cars, no noise. But this was the first time I noticed how the woods were quiet, too. No birds, no insects, no squirrels rustling around, no animals scurrying away at the sound of me crunching the leaves. I guess all the animals have left town. I hope Kansas lets them in. I could see from a distance that there was someone already skating. I had a rush of excitement. For one totally ridiculous moment, I thought it was Dan. But as I got closer, I could see, whoever he was, he actually knew how to skate. I stood still for a few moments and watched as the skater landed double axels. For a second, I thought I should just go away. But I was too excited. I practically ran the rest of the way to the pond to see if I could be right. If it really could be Brandon Ehrlich. It was. "You're alive," I said, as he bowed to my applause. "I may be, but my quad sure isn't," he said. "We thought you were dead," I said. "I mean, your fans did. You were training in California. We didn't hear anything about you." "I was touring," he said. "We were safe and sound in Indianapolis. It took a long time to get word to my parents, and it took even longer to get back here. But I've been here for a few months now. Do you skate too?" I looked down self-consciously at Mom's skates. "I used to," I said. "I used to take lessons with Mrs. Daly." "Really?" he said. "She was my first coach." "I know," I said. "Sometimes she'd tell us how you were doing. We all rooted so hard for you. I bet you'd have medaled at the Olympics." Brandon grinned. "My mom still thinks that's going to happen," he said. "Like, suddenly everything's going to be okay by February." "Were you any good? Did you compete?" "A little bit," I said. "On the intermediate level. I had most of my doubles, and I was working on a triple toe when I broke my ankle. Not even from skating. Just one of those dumb accidents. I took up swimming after that." "Swimming," Brandon said. "That's a lost art form. Put on your skates. Let's see how you do." "They're my mother's," I said. "I haven't been on the ice in a long time." It felt funny lacing up the skates while Brandon was watching. "Don't try any jumps," he said. "Just do some stroking. Let me see how your edges are." So I skated, and he skated alongside me. I was wobbly at first, but then I got my feet under me, and it felt almost natural being there. "Not bad," he said. "I bet Mrs. Daly was sorry when you stopped skating." I'd forgotten how glorious it felt to be skating, to glide across the ice. I never wanted to stop. But in just a few minutes, it was hard to breathe. "The air," Brandon said. "I've been at it for a couple of weeks now, and I've been building up resistance. Don't push too hard today. Give your lungs a chance to adjust." "Are your parents okay?" I asked after I caught my breath. "My mother knows your mother. You have enough food?" "Does anybody?" Brandon asked. "We haven't starved yet, so I guess we're okay." He stroked around the pond to build up speed and did a camel spin. Brandon used to have the most beautiful camel in the world. "Come on," he said. "How was your spiral? Up to Mrs. Daly's standards?" "No," I admitted. "My free leg was never high enough for her." "Then it's a good thing she isn't watching," he said. "Show me your spiral." It was an embarrassment. "Don't ask for my layback," I said. "I'm totally out of shape." "Well, you're certainly not overweight," he said. "If you practice enough, you should be fine. We'll hold our own Olympics. You can win the gold and the silver and the bronze." He reached out for my hand and we skated together. No sound but the sound of our blades. Well, mine mostly, against the ice. I knew he was skating slowly to keep pace with me. I knew I was keeping him from practicing his jumps, his spins, his footwork. I knew the world really must have ended because I was skating with Brandon Ehrlich, the way I had so often in my fantasies.
It really was heaven until I started coughing.
That's enough for one day, he said. How about watching me? I miss an audience.
So I stood by the side of the pond and watched Brandon do footwork and spin.